It's no secret to anyone here that we live in a dangerous world. Even worse, there seems to be little hope that it'll ever get better. In fact, we're not the only ones that notice that. Some formerly optimistic leading figures in the world are saying that mankind is obviously in for some pretty tough times. I'm going to read you a quote from a man that only most of the older ones among us will remember. He's Zbigniew Brzezinski. It was always hard to say his name when he was in the office. He was the National Security Advisor in the 1970s under President Jimmy Carter. In that role, of course, he spent a lot of time advising the president and others about how to bring peace to the world. Time magazine recently asked him for this current issue. Among many others, they asked the question. They asked Mr. Brzezinski, is world peace possible? And I want to read you his answer from this page in the magazine. Mr. Brzezinski's answer is this: genuine world peace, meaning effective consensus regarding shared sacrifices as well as voluntary cooperation, is theoretically possible. But world peace imposed by a dominant power, assisted by a few partners, is unlikely because global power is becoming increasingly diversified and contentious. Worldwide peace is most likely only some decades from now, when threats to humanity's existence generated by global warming, pollution, etc., become an imminent threat to all. In brief, only world peace driven by a recognition of the threat to everyone's survival is the most likely source of salvation for a short-sighted humanity currently not able to see and think beyond the immediate. Now, this is a man who's been there, who's awakened every morning trying to figure out, what do I tell the president today, and what are the conditions in the world, and where are we going, and how are we going to get there? And he says, there doesn't seem to be much likelihood that some dominant power, that is human political power, is going to bring peace in the world, because human political power has been diversified, and it's increasingly contentious, and nobody has that kind of authority and that kind of control. But there is hope that mankind will wake up. There's hope that mankind will see the deterioration of humankind's environment. And he uses, of course, not the human-created consequences necessarily, although you would say global warming and pollution are those, but sort of indirect, impersonal things. And he doesn't even mention war or the human nature's desire to conquer. But you know that he knows those things are there. But he says, ultimately, the only thing that will bring peace is for mankind to see that his entire survival is threatened and that man must work together. I'm paraphrasing now what he said, but that man must work together or he's going to all go down the tubes together. They asked several other well-known people, and the answers were all over the board. Of course, some of them were former hippies in the 60s, and some were just various cultural icons. Some were total optimists and airheads, I suppose would be fair to say. Some of whom said, oh yes, we're almost there. We're almost at world peace. After all, we're eliminating prejudices. We're eliminating racial prejudice. We're eliminating gender prejudices. We're eliminating, you know, social economic status, we're reducing all of that, so world peace is near on the horizon. Now, you can buy either of those conclusions you would like, but I think Mr. Brzezinski was far closer to the truth, and of course, we can ask somebody else that question. We can ask God that question, is world peace possible? And God gives us a simple, straightforward answer in a couple of places, lots of places, but I want to turn to a couple. Isaiah chapter 59, if you will, Isaiah chapter 59, if you know the books of the Bible. Mr. Kylo didn't mention this, but you probably noticed she did leave out one small book, but that's just one of those things that happens in a situation like that. She got 65 of them, and whether she earned her pearls or not, I don't know if he said. Isaiah chapter 59. Sometimes we make a mistake in expecting perfection. I thought her performance was pretty good. Okay, Isaiah chapter 59. Let's read in verse 8. God says it this way through the prophet Isaiah, and there's lots of other surrounding information which is applicable of our environment. But he says in verse 8, "The way of peace they have not known, and there is no justice in their ways. They have made themselves crooked paths. Whoever takes that way shall not know peace." So it's pretty clear that God says they don't know the way to peace. They haven't known it. They can't learn it, apparently. And they make themselves crooked paths, and when you go down crooked paths, you're not going to end up with peace. Paul repeats this in Romans chapter 3 for some emphasis here. Romans chapter 3 and verse 17. Romans 3:17. He's quoting the entire section of Isaiah there from verse 10 on down through verse 18. And verse 17, "In the way of peace they have not known." So Paul emphasizes that that was still true 600-700 years later in his day, and that mankind does not know the way to peace. So man doesn't know it. He can't find it. So does that mean that the human race is doomed to total destruction? Is mankind just going to cook himself or sometime blow up the world in such a dramatic fashion that there's no hope for anybody to survive? Well, of course, we have Christ's words in Matthew 24. Matthew 24, verse 21. Jesus doesn't say, "Oh, it's all going to be easy and it's all going to be good and you're going to kind of just coast right into a new world." I'm of an age where I remember when the big deal on the radio and television and the movies and so forth was, we're going to be living in a push-button world in just a few years. We're going to be living in leisure. People are going to have so much free time and relaxation, they won't know what to do with themselves. Well, to some degree, the push-button world was created, of course. Most of us push lots of buttons every day that do things that we would have had to do the hard way 50 years ago. But they did not bring so much relaxation and free time that we don't know what to do with it. In many cases, they brought a great deal more challenge. You know, I can tell you very clearly that in my work, behind the scenes, not the visiting and the preaching and the fun part of interacting with the brethren, but the behind the scenes work of the communicating with people, the writing, the editing, the ongoing administrative duties, the reporting, all the things that we do, far easier today on one level with the computer, because you can pull up information from whatever you've put down anywhere, and you can find it usually, most of the time, and you can collate things, and you can put together things that you would have had a great deal of work to do 50 years ago when we were doing it all by pencil. Most of you don't know this, but the old-timers do, that in the 60s, for example, and when I first came to Houston, the rule was that the ministry's time off was Saturday night and Monday afternoon. Because Sunday was a huge work day because we had lots of prospective members to visit. But our time off was supposed to be Saturday night and Monday afternoon. And Monday afternoon was only time off if you finished all of your reports by noon or whenever you got finished with your report. So if you had trouble doing it or lollygagged around and didn't get it done and didn't get your reports done until 4 o'clock, too bad. That's the rest. The rest of the day is your time off, and you go back to work early Tuesday morning. And doing the reports on Monday morning was a relatively complex job. Those reports take very little time these days. In fact, of course, we've also learned to delegate some of them now that we have the computers. You don't have to go drive around and pick up pieces of paper. You know, Dr. Erickson sends me at the beginning of a month, not the week, but at the beginning of a month, for example, because we have a monthly report, He sends me a note with the sermon titles and the attendances, and I fill out whatever else I want to put on the report that's casual comment, and hit a button, and boom, it goes off to headquarters. You never have to print it, never have to put it anywhere, never have to put my hands on it. It's just gone. And so, yes, we live in a push-button world that in a lot of ways made things easier, but guess what? Because now we have that capacity, we doubled and tripled the work. So most of our ministry today, for example, are wearing, as I've told you before, many hats. We'll talk about that in future sermons. But we're wearing a lot of hats, and so you're always doing things that you would not have even been able to do before. And so because we have increased capacity, we, of course, expect increased production. And so that's what happens. So our push-button world, and that's not certainly just not true with me or the ministry. That is universal. The world expects a great deal more out of employees today than we did even back in the 40s when we were working 10, 12-hour days routinely, maybe 6 days a week. Now maybe people don't work nearly as many hours, but they are stressed and expected to work whenever they have to work and have very little time off in most cases. I think it was firing Chris and I, some of us were standing around a few weeks ago talking about the European model of 6 or 8 weeks off vacation a year. How can you take 6 or 8 weeks of vacation off per year? You know, you'd think it would be cheaper for the people in Europe to do their business over here because they can get people foolishly to work 52 weeks a year. Not even take a vacation. Just work 52 weeks and keep right on working. Seems like it'd be cheaper to have 52 weeks of labor instead of 44 or 46. Well, at any rate, we were coming to Matthew chapter 24, which is far more important and heavy. Matthew chapter 24, verse 21. For then there shall be great tribulation, such as has not been since the beginning of the world until this time, no, nor ever shall be. Christ said it's going to be worse than it's ever been. And of course, remember, he's answering the question, what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? And he's given lots of them, and we'll continue to flesh those out here in the coming verses. But he says it's going to get really, really bad, folks. Not going to get better. Verse 22, and unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved. And as we've always pointed out, he doesn't mean spiritual salvation. It means flesh being saved alive. That is, humanity would not continue to exist. There would be no flesh saved alive on this earth. But for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened. So, sort of parallel to what Mr. Brzezinski said, when it gets bad enough, he thinks that mankind will rally and say, let's get our act together and save ourselves from this. That's not going to happen. He's going to come to the point of his self-annihilation, and then Christ will intervene as that dominant power and put down all of these authorities and nations and rulers and governments and say, we're going to do it this way. And by the way, here is the way to peace, because God knows the way to peace. God understands what it takes to produce peace. But before peace comes, times are going to get bad. Let's look at some of the prophecies and see what produces the conditions that ultimately will envelop the earth on the political military side in this case, because there are several different ways we could look at this issue. But let's look at the political military side of the future, beginning in Daniel chapter 2. Now, for 80 or 90% of us in this room, none of this is in any way new, surprising material, but we can kind of tend to forget it or get a little bit rusty on it or not remember the general scenario. And I'm much more concerned with the general scenario and the broad picture than with every detail, because the details often trap us and get us all fouled up. That is because we don't know them, but sometimes think we do. Daniel chapter 2. Let's pick this up in verse 27. You are familiar enough with the book that I'll just remind us that the king has had a dream, and he is urgent to get the dream interpreted, but he can't remember what it was, or at least doesn't share what it was, and requires his magicians to interpret it without knowing what it was. And Daniel, they all said that was impossible, but Daniel asked for some time, went and prayed about it. The remarkable thing in one sense, when you look at this story, is that the king gave him time. He'd already said all the magicians are going to die. But when Daniel came and asked for favor, he gave it to him, God obviously intervening in that regard, along with Daniel's character and some of the things that no doubt the king was aware of. But in verse 27, we come to the point where Daniel begins to share the knowledge of the dream and the intentions with Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon. Verse 27, Daniel answered in the presence of the king and said, the secret which the king has demanded, good word there, the wise men, the astrologers, the magicians, and the soothsayers cannot declare to the king. But there is a God in heaven. Daniel doesn't just go in and spit out the dream. He takes advantage of the opportunity to lay it out before the king that there is a special reason that he's able to do this. There is a God in heaven who reveals secrets, and he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will be in the latter days. But he didn't make it known to you directly, did he? He's going to use me to explain it to you. God makes known to the king what will be in the latter days. Your dream and the visions of your head upon your bed were these. As for you, O king, thoughts came to your mind while on your bed about what would come to pass after this. And he who reveals secrets has made known to you what will be. Not what might be, not what could happen, but what will be, because God knows the future. Verse 30, but as for me, this secret has not been revealed to me. Now Daniel takes more time to recognize God's power and to remove himself from any special attention here, even though Nebuchadnezzar later lavishes it upon him. This secret has not been revealed to me because I have more wisdom than anyone living, but for our sakes who make known the interpretation to the king and that you may know the thoughts of your heart. So Daniel says, God's given it to me so that we can live, but also so that you can know what he wants you to know. What Daniel's saying without coming out and saying is, God gave you this dream in the first place, and now he's sending me to interpret it for you so that you know what the future holds and that you know that God is God. You, O king, were watching, and behold, a great image. This great image, whose splendor was excellent, stood before you, and its form was awesome. Now, we're not specifically told what the image is, but as you go down through the story, it's pretty clear that this image is a man. It's the image of a human leader. It's a great and awesome and powerful, splendid example of a human, and probably clearly evident as a human leader, perhaps a soldier, a warrior, a king. And then he begins to describe this image. Verse 32, this image's head was of fine gold. Its chest, again commonly referring to a man, its chest and arms of silver, its belly and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron, partly of clay. So Daniel describes the image all the way down from head to toe, starting with gold and ending with iron and clay at the bottom. And each of these separated from the other in sort of bands around the body so that it's obvious sections that are represented here. And that will be explained momentarily. You watched while a stone was cut out without hands, which struck the image on its feet of iron and clay and broke them in pieces. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold were crushed together and became like chaff from the summer threshing floor. So here's this great, powerful image made of these great, precious, and powerful, strong metals, but it's all ground up and becomes chaff. The wind carried them away so that no trace of them was found. This is a very thorough type of what's going to happen when the nations come to their end and Jesus Christ steps in. The middle of verse 35. The wind carried them away so that no trace of them was found, and the stone that struck the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. And of course, mountain in prophetic language is a kingdom or a king. Filled the whole earth. This is the dream. Now we will tell the interpretation of it before the king. So now we come to the details that you and I can know and understand. You, O king, are a king of kings, for the God of heaven has given you a kingdom, power, strength, and glory. And wherever the children of men dwell, or the beasts of the field and the birds of the heaven, he has given them into your hands. So Nebuchadnezzar ruled over everything and has made you ruler over them all. You are this head of gold. Now, there's the key, of course, to understanding the dream and the projection. You are this head of gold. But after you, now he puts in a time element, after you shall arise another kingdom inferior to yours, then another, a third kingdom of bronze. So he skips over the silver, but he says there will come a silver kingdom, then a bronze. And so we see that time and space are connected here. The time of the head of gold is Nebuchadnezzar's time. The time of the silver chest and arms is the time of the king to follow Nebuchadnezzar, and hence with the bronze which follows again, which will rule over all the earth. So these are successive world-ruling kingdoms. And the fourth kingdom shall be as strong as iron, inasmuch as iron breaks in pieces and shatters everything. As you know, gold and silver are considerably softer metals, and even bronze is, than iron. Shatters everything, and like iron that crushes, that kingdom will break in pieces and crush all the others. So whatever's come before becomes of no consequence to the kingdom of iron. And whereas you saw the feet and toes partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, the kingdom shall be divided. Yet the strength of the iron shall be in it, just as you saw the iron mixed with ceramic clay. And as the toes of the feet were partly of iron and partly of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly fragile. So there's going to be a mixture of human cultures and types, perhaps nations, languages, attitudes, that are going to be partly strong and partly fragile. As you saw iron mixed with ceramic clay, they will mingle with the seed of men. In other words, they're going to be an amalgamation of peoples who are not one people. They will mingle with the seed of men, but they will not adhere to one another, just as iron does not mix with clay. And in the days of these kings, notice again, in the days of these kings, what kings? He's already said there's Nebuchadnezzar, then after you the silver kingdom, then after that the bronze kingdom, then after that the iron kingdom, which, by the way, we know, of course, because he said you're this head of gold and here come these others, and the Bible clearly states that after that came the Medo-Persian Empire, which blew away the Babylonian Empire, and after that came Alexander and the Greeks, who blew away the Persian Empire. And after that came Rome, the Iron Kingdom, that blew away all of them. And so he says, then in the days of these kings, well, I said again, what kings? Not those four ruling kingdoms, because they are now gone, because time is passing, and you have others brought into the picture. And he says, in the days of these kings, meaning the end of the string of kings, which would end with the feet and the toes and the mixture of iron and clay, in the days of these
in the days of these kings,
in the days of these kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. So this takes us from Nebuchadnezzar, 700 BC round figures, all the way to the return of Jesus Christ. And we're now in 2015. So 2,000 years added to that 700 years. About 2,700 years of history laid out here in advance, which is what prophecy is, history written in advance. So when that time is complete, then God is going to set up a kingdom which is a permanent, everlasting, not to be destroyed kingdom. That kingdom is not going to be destroyed by some succeeding greater kingdom, as has happened with all of these kingdoms of men from Nebuchadnezzar forward. And the kingdom shall not be left to other people, not going to be left to human beings and their politics and their theories. It shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. Inasmuch as you saw that the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it broke in pieces the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold, the great God has made known to the king what will come to pass after this. That is, after this time, after you rule, Nebuchadnezzar. Here's what's going to happen. The dream is certain, and its interpretation is sure. So God had revealed all of this to Daniel, including the fact that here's what Nebuchadnezzar dreamed. Put yourself in that situation. Somebody walks up to you after service, "I had this incredible dream last night. I wish I understood it." And you say, "Well, what did you dream?" "I don't know." "But tell me what it means." "What? You know, you got to," that's what Nebuchadnezzar said to them. "You're just trying to buy time till I cool down. you know, you don't want to get your head chopped off, so you're making excuses, but I want to know what I dreamed, and it's impossible. Only God could reveal those secrets, which, of course, God does. So Nebuchadnezzar is the head of gold. Successive kingdoms become inferior as they go through time, inferior in terms of quality and value. But the fourth beast is iron, which is inferior in quality and in value, but is strong and able to smash all the others into pieces. The stone cut out without hands, meaning that it is not a human political device, but is supernatural, of course, is the stone, who is the chief cornerstone of the church, the chief cornerstone of the temple, and the head of the government during the millennium, Jesus Christ. So Daniel has made it clear, remember, back in verses 20 to 23, along in there, that only God can reveal these things. You and I do well to remember that, by the way. We would do well to remember that, because we always like to engage in guessing and speculation. No harm in that, as long as that's what it is. As long as it's just sort of our human theory, our thinking, our ideas of what could happen. The danger is when we begin to think we know, or we begin to base our lives on that, and we begin to make judgments and decisions based on our own personal private theory, when the scripture says that the scripture is of no private interpretation. We begin to think we know, or that we've hit upon some key, and we begin to build our lives around that specific detail, which is not either not revealed in the scripture, or we are misinterpreting in the scripture. And the chances of us interpreting it properly without God giving it to us are pretty slim, about as slim as the magician's interpreting Nebuchadnezzar's dream. We can speculate all we want above and beyond what the scripture tells us about the end time, but unless God reveals the secret things, we will not know them. God does say, and I'm not going to go back there, I'll refer to Deuteronomy chapter 29. It's easy to remember, it's Deuteronomy 29:29, where it says, the secret things belong to the Lord. The secret things belong to God, but those things which are revealed belong to us. So it's once God reveals them to us that we begin to have some understanding and reason to function within that framework. If God doesn't reveal it, then we don't know. Now, we believe as a church that God has revealed some of what we're talking about here to the church, even though you can read it in commentaries, you can read it in various places, and now in our modern day, even some of the religious groups have picked up some of this and are trying to use it. But I can tell you, and I'm sure Mr. Pierce and, some of our other long-term folks, the Fauchets probably, some of them that are sitting here, John's been around a long time, can tell you that back in the days when we first began to understand this, nobody in this country was preaching this material. And it was as if nobody knew it. It was as if the Bible had nothing to do with actual human events, with actual governmental or political or cultural activity in the world. The Bible was irrelevant to that. All you needed to know was Christ. Nobody was preaching the truth that God laid out here in a third almost of the Bible that is prophecy. But God revealed some of them to the church in a way that meant not just that we could write them down, as some of the commentaries do, but that we could understand them and apply them and look for those developments to come about. The difference being that instead of just looking at the history and saying, okay, those kingdoms were described specifically, because we later find them described, especially the Persian and the Greek, those were defined specifically, but that's it. That's the end of it. Whereas the prophecy clearly goes down to the time of the return of Jesus Christ. So some scholars were willing to accept the symbolism of Babylon, Persia, and Greece, but they couldn't project the rest of the 2,500 years, well, not that much, the rest of the 2,000 years until Christ returns. And so they, in a sense, sort of toss it aside and don't make anything of it. What do we learn from this short but jam-packed section of Scripture? First thing we should learn, perhaps, is that the kingdom of Babylon is the first in a long string of man's governments that would rule the earth but that it, the system that is pictured by that great image is going to be crushed by the returning Jesus Christ, and that he is going to set up God's government on earth. That's, you could almost synthesize and summarize this whole section of about 30 verses in one sentence. Man's rule is going to go from kingdom to kingdom until it's finally smashed by Jesus Christ, who's going to set up a kingdom that will endure forever. But God, in his mercy and love and perhaps a bit of even humor, describes for us what man's going to do. He's going to keep trying to rule the world, control everybody. And he's going to fail, and fail miserably, and then Jesus Christ is going to come and solve those problems. Now, we should also note that it's interesting, but also important, that things begin and end with Babylon. You know, Babylon flows from the first cities set up, probably Babel itself, set up after the flood by Nimrod, who becomes the antithesis of God, the adversary of God and of Jesus Christ, and a human representation of Satan's government on the earth. So a much greater detailed image of man's rebellion against God occurs in the time of Nimrod that is the same principle as what happened in the Garden of Eden. Because Satan deceived Eve, lured Adam, and caused Adam to turn against God and embrace Satan's way of life. Mankind has suffered ever since. Man came to the point where there would be no flesh saved alive, and God blotted it all out and said, okay, we'll start over with eight people. So eight people started over, but very quickly thereafter, Nimrod and his kingdom were established on the same principles that happened in the Garden of Eden: rejection of God and embracing of Satan's way. Embracing, by the way, all of those same pagan concepts that were described by Mr. Franks in the video a little while ago. So man's governments since the flood began with Babylon, not Nebuchadnezzar per se, but the concept of Babylon resisting God and man governing himself and rejecting God, began with Babylon, and it ends, in a sense, with Babylon in a different form, which is a combination of the political and religious system that man has created down through time. So the first human kingdom set up by Nimrod in defiance of God in an organized system that we're told about in the Bible, because we don't get a lot of that information prior. There were kings and there were various rulers, obviously even in Abraham's day, but we don't get a lot of that information except from the Garden of Eden. Then we find it again after the flood, and we see that man set up government in defiance of God, and he's going to stay in defiance of God until Christ returns and the stone smashes the feet, which in this sense represent the final revival of man's governments, and symbolically, of course, are the foundation of the image that stands on his feet. So the whole foundation of man's government is going to be crushed. So there's no question here that man's rebellious governments over man are going to come to a dramatic end, because man has never really had the authority and the right to rule over men outside of God, because God is the king, and Christ is coming to acknowledge that. Let's move over to Daniel chapter 7, get a few more pieces of the puzzle. I don't expect you again to keep all the details in your mind, but let's at least understand what we're reading. Daniel chapter 7. Now Daniel himself has dreamed a dream, and he says in verse 15, I, Daniel, was grieved in my spirit within my body, and the visions of my head troubled me. I came near to one of those who stood by and asked him the truth of all of this. Apparently an angel. So he told me and made known to me the interpretation of these things. So now Daniel gets his own dream interpreted. Verse 17, those great beasts which are four are four kings which shall arise out of the earth. Sound familiar? Four kingdoms, four successive world ruling kingdoms. They are four kings that will arise out of the earth. But the saints of the Most High shall receive the kingdom. Now we've got it condensed into two lines. All these kings are going to exist, but the saints are going to possess the kingdom. It's the same story, told with slightly different details, with slightly different emphasis. Saints of the Most High shall receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, even forever and ever. So even though Daniel has interpreted this to Nebuchadnezzar in his dream, he's now getting it fed back to him with some further detail, which he's allowed to write down here for us. Then I wished to know the truth about the fourth beast. Oh, don't you think he did? What about every one of us? We wish to know the truth about the fourth beast. In this case, that was way down beyond Daniel's time. But he wanted to know what's coming because that fourth beast sounded so awesome. I wish to know the truth about the fourth beast, which was different from all the others, exceedingly dreadful, with its teeth of iron and its nails of bronze, which devoured broken pieces and trampled the residue with its feet. Awesome power that just blotted out every opponent. Of course, this is the Roman Empire, and you know, if you study history, and I don't know how they put it today, but when I was in university in the early 60s in world civilizations class, I said that the only time the world had ever had peace was in something called the Pax Romana, which is the peace of Rome, which endured for about 200 years while Rome was so powerful nobody dared raise a hair. The peace was enforced by the Roman Empire in that sense, but it was a form of peace that they chose. It wasn't necessarily peaceful for the individual at the bottom of the heap. But it tramped in broken pieces everything. Then verse 20 says, and the ten horns that were on its head, and the other horn which came up before which three fell, namely that horn which had eyes and a mouth which spoke pompous words, whose appearance was greater than his fellows. So here the interpretation is recalling the dream and the expression of this horn, which you find way back in verse 8 or so. I was watching, and the same horn was making war against the saints and prevailing against them. So here in the context of world-ruling empires, you have a statement about this power making war even against the saints, seemingly separately from war against Jesus Christ, because it says he prevailed against them, verse 22, until the Ancient of Days came and a judgment was made in favor of the saints of the Most High, and the time came for the saints to possess the kingdom. So you get another condensed version of what's happening. So the explanation goes on now in verse 23. Thus he said, the fourth beast shall be a fourth kingdom on the earth, which shall be different from all other kingdoms, and shall devour the whole earth, trample it, and break it in pieces. The ten horns are ten kings who shall arise from this kingdom. Now this becomes a little important because people tend to confuse these horns with ten horns mentioned in the book of Revelation and with the ten toes on the feet. And it's a little tricky to get it all straight. Sometimes you have to do as we have done, which is chart it out and say, here it means this, here it means this, these correspond to these, and get them straight. The ten horns are ten kings who shall arise from this kingdom, and another shall rise after them. He shall be different from the first ones and shall subdue three kings. He shall speak pompous words against the Most High, shall persecute the saints of the Most High, and shall intend to change times and law. Then the saints shall be given into his hand for a time and times and half a time. But the court shall be seated, and they shall take away his dominion to consume and destroy it forever. Then the kingdom and dominion and the greatness of the kingdom of the whole heaven shall be given to the people, the saints of the Most High. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey him. This is the end of the account. Interesting circumstances here now you have to think about, and of course, again, you can read it in our materials, you can study it in your scriptures and compare them in various chapters in Daniel and Revelation, which tend to interpret each other. But let me just sort of summarize it here through these last few verses. This Roman kingdom ends up being followed by, or an outgrowth of it, are these ten horns, these ten kings that are going to exist for a significant period of time, but the first three are plucked up. What are they plucked up by? They're plucked up by this other horn, which sort of comes out of nowhere. And the simple explanation, we'll come to more of this as we go through if we have time, and if we don't, we'll come back to it later, but the simple explanation is this other horn is not part of these empires. This other horn is the religious power with Satan's influence, which comes on the scene to take over the control of the political machinery that is normally a secular event. In other words, secular kingdoms are now suddenly being imposed upon by the religious power, which, notice, is not put in consecutive stages or doesn't get crushed with these kingdoms. It's still there fighting against the saints until Christ returns, as we read back in chapter 2. It's still there making war with the saints until the kingdom is established. So this other horn is not one of the consecutive kingdoms that arises. This other horn is a separate power in the name of the great false church that influences the powers of the secular governments. Now, briefly, without, again, trying to keep all this in your head necessarily, the first three horns that are plucked up are probably three of the early barbaric peoples that overran Rome that are then dispensed with when Pope Justinian in 554 AD manages to reestablish the Roman Empire, and the church and the empire take on a marriage or a partnership, a relationship that continues to our day today. Try to make that just a little bit clearer by repeating it a little bit differently. These three kings, or three groups of dominant peoples, are overcome by the papacy, who then begins to interact with the empire by establishing the Roman emperor again, this time not just as the Roman Empire, but as the Holy Roman Empire, because now it has a religious element. And we'll see a little later in Revelation 17 and 13 and other places that this is called by God the woman riding the beast. The beast is the physical, secular, human government. The woman is the church that is in league with those human governments and, in a sense, controls them. The beast has the power and the strength, but the woman rides it. The woman guides it. I was just looking through some of our pictures recently, and there's a picture of Judy and me riding on an elephant. I think we had it here when we had our 50th anniversary, but we're riding on an elephant in Thailand. Now, I'll tell you this. I wasn't piloting that elephant. I wasn't guiding that elephant. The guy down below walking with it was guiding it, but when he gets on it, he can guide it. Those guys can get on an elephant and drive it wherever they want it and make it pick up logs. They did demonstrations for us. But it's kind of that kind of thing. He was the brains. I'm sitting on top of the elephant, riding the elephant. The elephant can do things I could never even think of doing, but I can control the elephant. That's the way it is with this beast, which is far greater than any elephant, but the analogy kind of works. And so the church is riding the beast, which means the church is in control. The church is calling the shots, if you will. And if you look back through that history, you see that all of those kings were crowned by the Pope. Came to Napoleon, of course, he was cocky enough that he reached out and took the crown from the Pope and put it on his own head, but still he was there because the Pope had the authority supposedly to crown the emperor, because the church, in a sense, was in control. Let me catch up with my notes. We can look back at history today and it becomes pretty clear, but Daniel didn't have that opportunity. He was looking at a dream and looking at the interpretation and trying to look forward and think forward. And still, of course, he understood from having already talked to Nebuchadnezzar that the thing was sure and that God was going to bring it about. So what we see is the same truth we saw in Daniel chapter 2. That there are four great world-ruling kingdoms on the earth from the time of Daniel to the time of Jesus Christ. Now, the fourth one is divided into several parts. Even the third one is divided into several parts, because God later describes this beast as having seven heads. You have to sort of start to put all the pieces together and figure out how God is using different imagery to bring about an understanding of what's actually happening in the world around us without saying it in direct terms. He's giving it in dreams and analogies and in symbolism. The fourth kingdom, which later becomes the last kingdom, the seventh and the eighth, as he puts it in various terms, is the one that's going to be put down by Christ at his return. Now, we know that those four kingdoms, again, were Babylon, the Persian Medo-Persian Empire, the Medes and the Persians. The third was Alexander the Great and the Greeks, and the fourth was the Roman Empire. So the Roman Empire is going to come back again by the end of the age under that same influence of the driver of the beast, and is going to be the one that fights against Jesus Christ when he comes. Now, the reason, I should ask, what is the reason that this beast is, as he said, is diverse from all the rest? Is it not only because of his strength, but because of his continuity over the centuries? In other words, the fourth one persists. The fourth one, you don't have somebody coming and crushing the fourth until Jesus Christ does that. That beast continues. It's diverse from all the rest. It continues. It is resurrected, in a sense, over and over, though that final resurrection takes place in the end of the age. It has feet of iron and clay, some kind of a mixture that is not strong like the iron was. And so the final empire, still a powerful empire, still guided by the church, now has feet of iron and clay, which means it has weaknesses, and that they're not going to coalesce to the point of having the power they want to have, and they certainly are vulnerable to the stone cut out without hands, which is Jesus Christ. What we understand is that before the return of Christ to this earth, there will be a modern resurgence of that Roman Empire based in Central Europe, which right now is in turmoil, and there may be a good reason that it's in turmoil in terms of prophecy. That's for us to try to figure out as we watch unfolding developments day by day. Mankind is trying to figure it out, trying to figure out what would be the consequences of the euro coming apart, of the European community coming apart. You and I can pretty much predict what those consequences will be, at least I can. Not on my own, but based on what God says. That there are going to be, in the end time, 10 of those kings who give their power 1 hour to the beast. The rest of them probably all disappear from the scene in some any meaningful, being a part of it in any meaningful way. And so there's no question, probably, in most people's thinking, as you look at the scripture, no question that the present European community will make some changes and undergo some drastic rearrangements and compromises before that end of the age in which now that Roman Empire is restored, and certain of those countries are probably not going to be any part of it. They're part of that economic union now. Some of them are even Israelite nations, the UK being, of course, the most obvious, children of Joseph, talked about recently. But it's going to undergo some challenges, but then what comes out of that? Even the secular reporters and pundits is the common word, but the people who are in the know on these things, look at Europe and say, if Europe goes through this kind of crisis, probably in the aftermath of that will coalesce a Europe that is much more closely knit and stronger than the current 26 nations or whatever there are that are currently in the community. I've forgotten the numbers now. They come and go. But that empire is going to be based on the same principles of Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome that have ruled the world in the past. The same pagan concepts and the same human authority rejecting God's authority and wanting nothing to do with God. While they talk about God, of course, in behind the scenes. Same pagan religion, same economic principles, same power military principles. It will believe itself invincible at the end. It will believe it can fight against Jesus Christ. Now, there's another piece of the puzzle that we've talked about, but let's go and read, and then I think we'll break after that instead of trying to squeeze in the rest of the material today. But let's go to Revelation chapter 13. You know, when you're preparing these notes, they seem simple enough, and you want to just kind of read right through them, but when you start thinking about it and reading it while you read, and hopefully under some inspiration, which we pray for, you find that it takes more time and effort to cover the material than you anticipate when you're sitting at the desk. Revelation chapter 13, verse 1. And again, many people read this in the book of Revelation, and they don't connect it at all with the book of Daniel, so they're sort of lost, and vice versa. Chapter 13. Then I stood on the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rising up out of the sea. Now, right away, of course, you first have to understand the biblical symbolism and know that the sea is a sea of people, that it's humanity. Often called, even in our literature, the sea of humanity, that is, in human writing. But what does it have? It has 7 heads and 10 horns, and on his horns 10 crowns, and on his heads a blasphemous name. Now, this is not Daniel, this is the Apostle John getting the revelation from Jesus Christ. Now, the beast which I saw was like a leopard. His feet were like the feet of a bear. His mouth like the mouth of a lion. So this kingdom, or this beast, which we now know to be a kingdom, amalgamates many of the characteristics of the other kingdoms. The dragon gave him his power, his throne, and great authority. Ah, the dragon gave him his power and his throne and great authority. Now, the devil's done that all along for 6,000 years for secular thrones and kingdoms, hasn't he? But he also has influenced religion and the churches for that same period of time. He's created all the various religions and the pagan practices and even the pseudo-Judaic Christian practices. Most of them are counterfeits influenced by, if not outright created by, Satan the devil, stirred up in mankind to contradict God's purpose. So it shouldn't surprise us that the dragon, that is Satan the devil, gave him his power, his throne, and great authority. Dropping down to verse 11 here, if we can. Then I saw another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had 2 horns like a lamb and spoke like a dragon. Ah, now we're not talking about the political secular governments. We're moving to the other side of the picture. He exercises all the authority of the first beast in his presence. So the religious power exercises the same kind of authority that the secular power exercises. Let me go back to verse 12. He exercises all the authority of the first beast in his presence and causes the earth and those who dwell in it to worship the first beast whose deadly wound was healed. Whoa, we're introduced to something new now, a deadly wound that's healed. And exercising the power of that beast in a different way. And notice it says those who dwell in it to worship the first beast. He performs great signs so that he even makes fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men. We haven't had physical, human, secular governments do that yet, have we? This is a spiritual, supernatural, special event that this individual can do signs that make him pretty impressive and pretty credible. And what happens as a result of being credible and impressive, verse 14, the natural human response, and he deceives those who dwell on the earth by those signs which he was granted to do. Notice, granted to do. God allows that in the sight of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image to the beast who was wounded by the sword and lived. Starts to get really intriguing here if you're making a movie. And figure out how all these characters come together and what the conclusion of the matter is going to be. Pretty powerful imagery. Verse 15, he was granted power to give breath to the image of the beast. So now we have a beast and the image of a beast. And the image of the beast is exercising the same power that the first beast did, but it's also telling people to worship the first beast. That the image of the beast should both speak and cause as many as would not worship the image of the beast to be killed. So now this second beast, this image of the beast, this religious power, takes on such authority that it is able to demand that those who will not yield to the secular power are going to be killed. Because the secular power has become the instrument of power of the religious power. The religious power is riding the beast, but the beast is doing all the hard work. And so the driver of the beast is saying, you have to submit to the beast. You have to worship the beast. My beast. Or you will be killed. He causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hand or on their foreheads, that no man may buy or sell. Now the economic picture comes into view. No man may buy or sell except one who has the mark of the name of the beast or the number of his name. Here is wisdom. Let him who has understanding calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, his number is 666. So now you get into all the numerology and all the various research forms to try to figure out what does that mean. And we can cover all of that. We may not discuss all of those details, but it's easily discernible. Even AARP newspaper, forgot what they call it, the AARP something, this week mentions the beast in 666, but in an unusual way. The article's about Social Security, and it simply points out that when Social Security was first established back in 1935, they made a decision from the beginning that no card numbers would start with 666, because it was perceived to be the number of the beast in the book of Revelation. It actually says that in AARP magazine. So again, people have sort of played with this stuff, and they know a little bit about it, and enough to be afraid of the idea of it, but not enough to understand it and really come out of what causes them to be deceived and under the power of the beast. So this lamb with the two horns is a religious power. It is that other horn that we talked about from Daniel chapter 7. All right, because of time and the transition here to the book of Revelation and others, I'm going to leave this for now to be continued. Now, it won't be continued next week because Mr. Kylo is going to be here and be our guest speaker. Headquarters tries to send somebody every quarter. It hasn't always worked out either for them or us, but Mr. Kylo will be here as our speaker next week. The following week, I am in Victoria, and I believe Mr. Pierce is speaking. No, Chris is speaking, I think. Anyway, somebody's speaking on the 25th, so I'll see you in about 3 weeks, and I'll try to pick this up from here unless something urgent happens, and it may be something even urgent enough in the world that we can tie it back into this, but let's see. Let's see where we are a couple of weeks from now. So I hope that you've understood at least part of what we're talking about, and if it's not fresh in your mind and you want to ask questions at some point, feel free to do that. Probably be easier to talk to you on email or in writing than in person, but I don't mind discussing it in person, except I don't carry all those details always in my head either. All right, hope you have a really good week, and pray for one another and for the brethren that are sick, and we'll see you next week, and we should have Mr. Kylo present in church. So I hope all goes well for you. I did talk to Mr. Seaver on Thursday night before his surgery yesterday, and he seemed chipper, and Frank talked to him this morning, and he was doing okay. And I think everybody's sort of on the mend at the moment as far as the updates that we currently have. Chris?